Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This year, 2024, marks the 110th anniversary of World War I, which began in the month of August 1914, which was also the month that ended the Second World War 31 years later in 1945 with an atomic bang. The nearly two decades between the wars might simply be considered a period of time to grow another generation to continue the immense slaughter that engrossed the middle of the final century of the second millennium after the crucifixion of a religious figure reputed to have been purposely sacrificed for all of humanity's transgressions against itself and the finite planet we dwell upon. The core event of the second millennium is the genesis of the nuclear age, which might also renumber the human calendar prior to its possible eventual homicidal holocaust, which would conceivably leave Mother Gaia a dead planet like the rest of Sol's heavenly brood. Of course, unless there really is life on Mars, as sci-fi fans love to speculate. And now, by Neha Masi, a newsroom expands and the onion is out again on paper. Not kidding. In the summer of 2013, a few months before its print edition shuttered, The Onion wrote an almost prophetic obit, print dead at 1,803. Now, 11 years later, the satirical news outlet that dubs itself America's finest news source is hoping to make paper great again with a return to print. A print edition debuted this past week in its home base of Chicago, just as the Democratic National Convention got underway and readers have raced to sign up for their copies. Also this week, the Star Tribune in Minneapolis unveiled an ambitious makeover. The 157-year local paper will now be the Minnesota Star Tribune, expanding its statewide coverage and launching a sleek website redesign. The two expansions come at a time of great upheaval and shrinking of the U.S. media industry and offer cautious optimism about its future. Newspaper circulation has fallen in recent years, revenue has plummeted, and technological advancements have disrupted the market. The numbers are bleak. There are 204 counties in the United States without any local news outlet. Newspapers are disappearing at an average rate of more than two a week, and overall employment at newspapers has dropped by more than 70% since 2005, a report from Northwestern University has found out. And yet, the Onion's announcement has gone unbelievably, shockingly well, quote-unquote, CEO Ben Collins said by telephone, adding that an influx of new subscribers overwhelmed their payment system over the weekend. The numbers are crazy, said Collins, who joined as CEO in April, although he did not share a figure. Experts say that while the developments offer hope, the challenges confronting the industry are glaring. I think we are way past the point of crisis and firmly in decline and fall, at least for the institutional news media, Nick Usher, a professor of communication studies at the University of San Diego, said in an email. These developments are the exception, not the rule, but that's okay, because enough exceptions to the rule and you get a recalibration in how the news industry might reimagine itself, Usher added. The changes in coverage and expansion will aim to serve reader interest the Star Tribune's editor, Suki Dardarian, said by email. Much is changing, yet we will remain committed to watchdog journalism and reporting on the challenges facing us in Minnesota, as well as speaking to the spirit and soul of Minnesotans, she wrote. The paper, which was founded in 1867, navigated choppy waters in 2009 when it filed for bankruptcy. It was ultimately acquired by billionaire and former state senator Glenn Taylor in 2014. Its rebounding comes at a time when the Midwestern state is enjoying the national spotlight, with Governor Tim Walz's ascent as the Democratic vice presidential candidate. Dardarian said the paper had remained profitable, quote, because we have a very civically engaged audience, unquote, and a committed owner. Victor Picard, a professor of media policy and political economy at the University of Pennsylvania, agreed that these cases must be recognized as exceptions and said it is increasingly undeniable that there is, quote, no viable commercial future for many forms of local journalism, unquote. The Onion's decision to go old school was, in part, fueled by demand from readers. Collins said, in my head, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. It's 2024. What are you talking about? He said of his initial reaction to the idea. But the internet has gotten more toxic, he added, with AI garbage and violence and horror all the time, prompting the company to look into the economics of the venture. To power the print edition, the company will rely on subscriptions, ads, events, and has plans for video offerings, said Collins. The irreverent media company has faced a turbulent few years with layoffs, cutbacks, and ownership changes. The Onion was bought by Global Tetrahedron earlier this year, and its owners include Jeff Lawson, co-founder of cloud communications company Twilio. The coolest thing about this weekend so far are these people texting their grandparents who had stacks of the Onion in their basements saying, the paper is back, Collins said. The outlet garnered a lot of traction among young audiences on TikTok in recent months over its scathing headlines taking aim at the mainstream media's coverage of the war in Gaza. Look, we're not the Washington Post. We do a lot more fun things than you guys do, Collins said in classic Onion style. We're saying this is something that you're going to really like, and it can give us $5 to make it every month. We'll put that into your house, and I think that's a very back-to-basics thing people want. Picard, however, warned that the future could remain dismal. In seeking alternatives to the collapsing newspaper industry, we need a systemic fix to ensure that everyone's information needs are being met, and no new business model will guarantee that. Local journalism is an essential public service. It's through this democracy frame, and that's a quote, that we should be evaluating the state of journalism today, he said. And I, as the last publisher of the North Coast Times-Eagle, applaud them very, very much. And now, by Charles M. Blow for the New York Times, another nasty woman strikes fear in Trump. Misogyny has been central to Donald Trump's identity, rise, and political movement, but it is now central to his distemper, as Kamala Harris's remarkable campaign rollout has frustrated and unnerved him. Part of his brand has been that even churlishness is better than anything that even hints at girlishness. Trump praises autocrats, male autocrats that is, calling them strong, smart, and savvy. even once described Kim Jong-un as honorable. Surely, visions of unrestrained power dance in his head. But when Trump talks about women who in any way challenge his power, his rhetoric grips with sexism. In recent days, he has referred to Harris as incompetent, nasty, and not smart. Behind closed doors, he has reportedly referred to her repeatedly using the B word. Is there a nexus? Writing in 2022 for Foreign Affairs, the Harvard Kennedy School scholars Erica Chenoweth and Zoe Marks explained that the 21st century, quote, is demonstrating that misogyny and authoritarianism are not just common commodities, but mutually reinforcing ills, unquote. Authoritarian tendencies and misogyny rise together, illustrated in Trump's case, not only by the things he says to and about women, but also in the way his worldview seems to inform some of his policy positions. He was hoping, in part, to ride gender inequality, his efforts at dismantling reproductive rights, and his co-signing of anti-trans hysteria to a second term. The distillation of Trump's patriarchal bent is his implicit message that the status of men, particularly white men, is under attack by the undermining of his version of traditional norms of masculinity and the rising stature of assertive women and minorities. This is one of the main reasons Harris has disconcerted him. Her campaign, that of a confident, upbeat woman of color, is more or less the antithesis of his. So Trump has fumed about Joe Biden being a sort of stalking horse for Harris, forcing Trump to spend months, for naught, campaigning against the president rather than the vice president. So far, he has come across as rigid and ornery, seemingly unable to contain his fury that a woman, this woman, is threatening a victory that he felt was insured. In a way, Trump has been reaching into an old playbook to attack Harris, using sexist tropes that he has used before against female rivals and critics, tropes that were, sadly, more effective in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, but now feel shopworn and make him look more pathetic than potent. On this past Monday, during a rambling conversation with Elon Musk, broadcast on X, Trump called Harris's replacement of Biden at the top of the Democratic ticket a scam and a coup. It was reminiscent of all the times that Trump suggested or said outright that Hillary Clinton had stolen the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders. Put together, it's hard not to come away with the conclusion that in Trump's mind, the only way that these women could have emerged as their party's standard bearers and as his rivals was as a result of some sort of skullduggery. And he almost never misses a chance to unleash one of his sexist asides, even when talking about policy. During their third debate, Clinton discussed how and why she planned to raise taxes on wealthier Americans like her, and Trump punctuating her explanation with assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. His retort was really no surprise. Such a nasty woman, quote unquote. As my newsroom colleague Claire Kane Miller wrote at the time, insults of powerful women by men perform a particular role, researchers say, cutting them down to size and playing into discomfort with women in power. And that's a quote. Ever since Harris became Democrats' presumptive nominee, Trump has consistently strayed from the issues that people care about most to take personal, often superficial swipes meant to denigrate her, but that only illustrate his insecurity. Toward the end of his discussion with Musk, Trump complained that Harris was getting a free ride, citing her recent Time magazine cover portrait, which he seemed to suggest was too flattering. "She looks like the most beautiful actress ever to live," he said. This coming from a man who a few years ago was revealed to have displayed a fake Time cover with his face on it. All this points to the fragility of Trump's masculine pose. It also exposes his fear. A woman of color, twice disadvantaged in the white male-dominated patriarchy, is threatening the position of a man who has become the totem of that patriarchy. And that was by Charles M. Blow, "Another Nasty Woman," and that's a quote, "strikes fear in Trump," which he wrote for the New York Times. And now, at the request of Julius Maxwell Belcher, with whom I shared much of our short experience in a very long war 58 years ago, I spent my 25th birthday on a reconnaissance patrol in the mountains of South Vietnam, north of Chu Lai, up near the DMZ. We were looking for a suspected Viet Cong hospital in a hollowed-out mountain known to Vietnamese as Nui Kem, that had once been the most extensive and apparently richest gold mine in French Indochina. If we had found a hospital, we would have marked it for destruction by airstrikes and infantry, contrary to rules of warfare doctrines, and we might have had to do some immediate damage to get out alive. Seven of us spent the day prowling through a huge complex of tunnels and shafts burrowed into the mountain by thousands of obviously indentured Vietnamese during the days of French colonialism. We were armed with pistols, flashlights, and a scout dog, and hauled with us what seemed several miles of cord line so that we could find our way back out. We found the mine entrance by chance on my birthday after a couple of days of searching for it, a small hole that seemed to breathe from inside the mountain. It was concealed among overgrown rubble left when the French bombed the mine to prevent the victorious Viet Minh from finding it a dozen years earlier. The entire mountain seemed honeycombed with large tunnels. We were able to explore only a few levels near the bottom. I felt like Tom Sawyer looking for Injun Joe, but we found nothing except a few spectral-like footprints in some shafts and mysterious handprints on dusty rocks in huge caverns. That night, as we camped out next to the mountain, near a stream that coursed through the valley, we thought we were under attack by Viet Cong battalions rumored to be in neighboring valleys. Our attackers turned out to be very thirsty howler monkeys we had chased away from water when we entered the valley a few days earlier. We were vastly relieved and slightly unhinged when we discovered they were only a horde of monkeys as they swept past us toward the stream. I returned to the USA on my 26th birthday the following year. A small Marine Corps band awaited us at the pier in San Diego with a few friends and families of Marines and sailors aboard the ship that brought us home. The band was a tawdry, probably hungover, ragged collection of jarheads in disheveled uniforms, playing military marches half-heartedly and off-key. I thought of the ticker tape parades and crowds of thousands who greeted returning veterans from the world wars, and in comparison, looking at the tepid welcome we received, I was more than aware that Vietnam was a second-class war. Of course, we were only a single shipload of survivors in an early year of the Vietnam War, but the rest of the war only confirmed my opinions. John Michael Sweeney, one of my Corps friends when we were both U.S. Marine Corps war correspondents in Vietnam in the early years of that decade, long, long ago war, has died after a very long illness. We were both grunt USMC reporters, primarily attached to infantry outfits, search and destroying peasant rice paddy deja vu villages near the so-called demilitarized zone that separated North from South in that bitter ideological civil war the USA side lost. Two other survivors phoned to tell me of Sweeney's death after a long debilitating illness, most likely the result of his Vietnam experience. Now only four of us are left of my Corps USMC compatriots and colleagues. Julius Maxwell Belcher, who was raised in Liberia, South Africa, Pat Collins from Middle West USA, Paul Pappas from Minneapolis, as was Sweeney. They were casual friends in college, and native Southern Californicated me. One other of us, Albert Mitchell from California, also disappeared from the rest of us survivors of the same batch of USMC combat reporters and photographers that early year of the Vietnam War. Now, more than half a century and the bifurcation of two millennia in the past. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. If the grand old party of the Republic is either unwilling or incapable of coming up with another candidate for president of the USA than Donald Trump, who publicly announces his intention to rule as a despot and whose initial presidency is overwhelmingly considered the worst in U.S. history, it deserves to be overwhelmingly defeated this November and once again reformed into the party resembling its Lincoln-esque past, without a civil war this time.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.